Well, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today. It is Tuesday, August 2nd. This is Richard Clem. I'm coming to you from St. Paul, Minnesota. We're doing a conference call on Part 3 of Ethics Refresher 2011, and we'll be starting with Rule 1.15 of the Rules of Professional Conduct in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Iowa, which are all pretty much identical. We're recording today's program for Wisconsin podcast listeners. So if you're listening to the podcast, I will be giving a couple of code words during the program. And write those down, unless you're driving, write those down, and then you can return those to me for your certificate of completion. And like I say, we parts 1 and 2, we've covered up through Rule 1.14, and we're going to be starting with Rule 1.15. So today we're going to be talking about safeguarding your client's property, which includes money, which includes trust accounts, which is why Rule 1.15 takes up a little bit more space in the rules and takes up a little bit more time in the program. Unlike many of the other rules, for those of you who have been listening to earlier parts, most of the rules are pretty much identical. Rule 1.15, however, is where they depart just a little bit in the three states. We'll be talking about Minnesota and Wisconsin because we have listeners for that, and we might mention some of the high points of the Iowa rules, too, because sometimes it's even though we don't have any Iowa participants online today, it's still sometimes interesting to see the little twists that they have on them. And in fact, in particular, Iowa has one pretty good resource that even lawyers in other states might want to take a look at. In general, the Iowa rule is very general. Minnesota has a little bit more specificity, and the Wisconsin rule goes into greater detail. The reason why the Wisconsin rule goes into greater detail is because on the in the area of trust accounts, the Wisconsin rule is very comprehensive, whereas in Minnesota and Iowa, it makes reference to another document that is updated annually in the case of Minnesota that has a lot of the very specific requirements for trust accounts. So for the Minnesota lawyer who's handling client funds, you should take a look at that that other document that we'll get to in a few minutes, at least on an annual basis, just to kind of refresh yourself on what the requirements are as far as how your trust account has to work and the record-keeping requirements that go along with that, and also the record-keeping requirements for your law practice, even if you don't have a trust account. There are certain books and records that you have to maintain, and they are covered in that separate Minnesota document. And when we get to that, you'll see there's a link in the materials that covers that. But Rule 1.15 talks about safeguarding your client's property, and the issue where that comes up most frequently is safeguarding your client's money, because many times you will come into possession of money that belongs to your client or to third parties. And the general rule that applies almost 100% of the time is that any time money comes into your hands that belongs to somebody other than you, that money must go into a trust account of some kind. And the rule is phrased such that any money that comes into your possession in connection with a representation has to go into a trust account. And we'll talk in a minute about the two different kinds of trust accounts, depending on basically on the amount of money involved. So in general, money belonging to your client can't go into your account. It has to go into a trust account. And almost as important a rule to that is that money belonging to you cannot go in the trust account. And there's only a couple of small exceptions to your money being in the trust account. The first situation is that if the bank has a service charge associated with the trust account, then you can deposit into your trust account amounts that are reasonably necessary to cover the service charges for the account. So, for example, if the bank charges $12 a month for the service charge on a trust account, you can, you know, deposit $12 in your account and you're okay. Or you can probably deposit $24 in your account to cover 2 months' worth of service charge. You can probably put in $36 to cover 3 months' worth of service charge. What you can't do, though, as you'll see, this could run you into trouble if you thought about doing this. You probably can't put $1,000 in your trust account to cover the service charge, because that's probably not a reasonable amount to cover a $12 a month service charge or something. Now, the reason why that kind of becomes an issue is with your personal checking account or with your office checking account, or any time you have an account with a bank. Some people are not maybe very good with math, and to avoid overdrafts, sometimes what you might want to do is just put an extra, you know, $100 or $1,000 cushion in the account, so that if you if your bank account balance is $24 and you write a check for $25, then you're going to have an overdraft if that happens. So what some people do is instead of having $24 in your account, you keep an extra cushion in there, so you have $1,024. So if your math was off and you write that check for $26, well, then your balance doesn't go to -2, it goes to 998, and everything is still okay. But you're not allowed to do that with a trust account, because that $1,000 would not be a reasonable amount to cover the service charge. And as we will see below, you want to be very careful with your trust account, never to have an overdraft, because that a lot of bad things happen if that ever happens. If you have an overdraft in your personal checking account, that happens, and the bank will probably honor it, but they'll charge you a service charge or something. But if that happens in your trust account, you could get into trouble. But you're not allowed to have that cushion. So what it boils down to is even if you're not good at math, you have to start being good at math when it comes to your trust account. Because you're not allowed to have that cushion there to avoid overdrafts. So you do have to watch out. You're allowed to put a small amount, a reasonable amount, to cover the service charges. And you're also allowed, the only other situation where money belonging to you that can be in that account is money belonging to you and the client jointly. And the most common situation where that would come up probably would be a settlement in a civil case. So, for example, if you're representing somebody in a personal injury case and the case gets settled for $9,000 and you're doing it on a contingency fee, well, you'll get a check from the insurance company made payable jointly to you and to the client for $9,000. And $6,000 of that belongs to the client, and $3,000 of it belongs to you. But that check that comes will be made out jointly to both of you. So that has to be deposited into the trust account. When you get the check, you endorse the back, and the client endorses the back. You endorse it into the trust account, or you deposit it into the trust account, and then that is held because that's money belonging jointly to the both of you. The other situation where that could come up would be an advance fee, where a client gives you an advance fee, and you earn part of it, but not all of it. So for a certain period of time, it belongs to both of you jointly. Well, the next paragraph here in the materials covers that if at such time as the money does become yours, you have to withdraw it within a reasonable time after earning it. It doesn't say what a reasonable time is, but probably monthly would be reasonable. So if a client gave you a $10,000 retainer and you earned $1,000 this month, the $10,000 would stay in the trust account until you earned that first $1,000, and at that time you would take the money out of the trust account, the money you've earned, the $1,000, and deposit it into your office account. And in such situation, you have to make a written accounting. And as we'll see, there are the rules get pretty specific on what those accountings have to look like. At this point, for our Wisconsin podcast listeners, I will give the first code word, or actually a code phrase, is trust account. The first code word to get your Wisconsin podcast certificate of completion is trust account. A trust account. Okay, so those are the general rules kind of in all the states governing trust accounts. And like I say, we will get into some more specific rules. The rule does talk about other kinds of property. Securities and and other property that you receive from your client, they must be identified, they must be labeled, and the Minnesota rule states that they must be promptly placed in a safe deposit box or other place of safekeeping. Now, Wisconsin gets a little bit more specific on that. I believe it refers to that there are specific requirements on what the safe deposit box, the way that has to be set up. So if you're holding things, especially like bearer bonds or anything like that in Wisconsin, make sure that you take a close look at that rule, because I believe that rule will even require a separate safe deposit box for client property. You can't just use your own personal safe deposit box or the one where you have your office property or your personal property. So be sure to check that rule in Wisconsin if you're holding it. Minnesota doesn't go into a lot of specificity. It just says safe deposit box or other place of safekeeping. So if you're holding on behalf of your client a gold bar worth a lot of money, well, that should probably go in the bank safe deposit box. You probably don't just want to lock that in the file cabinet in your office. On the other hand, if you're holding in some kind of property settlement, you're holding the silverware worth $100. Well, maybe you can just lock that in your office file cabinet, but it has to be a place of safekeeping. Again, they have to be kind of labeled and segregated, and you have to keep records of such property and the specifics on what those records are covered by the rule. So this is one case where there is material in the rule that we're not covering in specificity. In other parts of the program, we kind of go into excruciating detail on some of them. But this one, if you do get into that situation, you do want to take a look at the rule. Property has to be returned to or delivered to the person who owns it or to the person entitled to receive it promptly upon request. Now, getting back to the trust account, an advance fee, and in the first part of the program, under Rule 1.5, we talked about the requirements for when you get a fee in advance. It can be done, but you have to look carefully at Rule 1.5. Anytime that you receive payment from your client before you have actually earned that money, which is a pretty common situation. So again, you have to look at Rule 1.5. But this rule stresses that anytime you do receive any kind of an advance fee like that, it does have to be deposited into your trust account and then withdrawn as earned. Again, take a look at Rule 1.5 on that as well. Well, as I mentioned, there can be two different types of trust account. It basically depends on how much money is involved and how long you are holding the money. If you are holding money only for a short period of time, then it will go into a pooled trust account that we'll get to in a minute. But the thing to keep in mind is that that money belongs to your client. It doesn't belong to you. It doesn't belong to the state. It belongs to your client. Therefore, the interest on that money belongs to your client. If you are holding money in a large amount or for a long period of time, the interest on that money really should go to your client. So, for example, if you have $1 million that you are holding on behalf of your client, and that money is going to be in your hands for 1 week, somebody in one of my programs crunched the numbers, and this seemed reasonable. 5% interest, that worked out to about $1,000 a week. So on that $1 million, I don't know if anybody's paying 5% right now, but it's a, that $1,000 belongs to the client because that is interest that has been earned on their money. Therefore, that money should go in a separate segregated account at the bank. So you would probably have to go to the bank and set up an account. Say, we have this check for $1 million that has to stay in this account for 1 week. And then that any interest earned on that money would go into that account. So instead of getting $1 million at the end of the week, the client would get $1,000,000. Because, like I say, that that interest money belongs to them. If you were holding, $1,000 for a year, or let's say $10,000 for a year, and let's say the bank is paying 5% interest. 5% interest on $10,000 is $500, if I'm not mistaken. So again, that $500 belongs to the client. It doesn't belong to you. It doesn't belong to the state of Minnesota or Wisconsin. It belongs to the client. So in that situation, you should probably set it up so that it's an interest-bearing account set up so that the client is the beneficial owner of that account. The Wisconsin rules in particular specify what interest rate you're required to get. Basically, you have to ask the bank for their best interest rate, what they're paying on similar accounts. So larger amounts like that, the thing to keep in mind is that the money belongs to the client, and therefore the earnings on that money also belong to the client. But more commonly in the practice of law, there will be situations where you have relatively small amounts of money that come into your hands, or you have amounts of money that come into your hands only for a very short period of time. So, for example, if you settle a personal injury case for $100,000, the interest on that would be $100 a week. But if it's a settlement check, that's going to be distributed within a day or two. So it's you're not even earning a week's interest on it. You're only earning a couple of days' interest on it. So in that situation, it's basically just not worth the accounting trouble to go to the bank and to open a separate account just to collect that $50 in interest or whatever that you're going to get for a few days. Or, for example, you get a retainer of $1,000 that you are going to be earning most of that within a month. So, there's $1,000 of your client's money, but it's only going to be in your hands for 1 month. That the interest of $1,000 for a month would be, somewhere in the ballpark of $10 or $20 or something. So it's really not worth the trouble of going to the bank to open a separate account. Well, what is used in that situation, you would put that money in your pooled account, a trust account, where you deposit all of these small amounts or short-term amounts, your pooled trust account, because it's pooled together with all of your other clients' money. And in all three of the states, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa, that is called the IOLTA account. And IOLTA stands for Interest on Lawyers Trust Accounts. And what the IOLTA account is, this money presumably can be earning interest. And that interest belongs to your client. But it's such a small amount of money that it's really not worth the accounting work to figure out how much interest each client gets. Therefore, all of the states have set up the IOLTA account which is basically the only kind of trust account that is allowed for pooled amounts. With the IOLTA account, it still collects interest, but that interest is sent to the state, to the state of Minnesota or the state of Wisconsin, and the state uses that money that's collected to fund a fund to compensate victims of attorneys who have absconded with client money. So there's this pool of money. So in your trust account this month, you earned 42 cents interest. That 42 cents is sent to the state of Minnesota or the state of Wisconsin. And all those 42 senses from all the lawyers in the state add up, and they have enough money to operate this fund. You know, the thing to keep in mind about that, I mean, when these were set up, it was kind of, everybody kind of looked upon it as free money. But it's essentially a tax on clients of attorneys. And it's a small tax because no individual person pays very much of it. But that's essentially what it is. They take money from your clients and they use that for a public purpose. So even though they never use the word, it's really a tax. Now, as I mentioned, there can be service charges on these accounts, and it seems to me that if the banks who administered these accounts really wanted to. And they really did charge a $12 a month service charge. Well, in most cases, there would never be any money going to the state, and the system would kind of collapse, I think, if the bankers put their foot down on this, because I don't know if I've ever had a situation where I've had more than $12 a month interest in my trust account. That would be, in my practice, that would be very rare. I guess if I had settled a $1 million case or something, then the interest for a day or two would be a big enough number, but the interest remittances in my account are rarely, I don't know if they've ever been more than $1. And on these accounts, the bank is authorized, if they want to charge a service charge, and the interest paid is net of that service charge. So if the banks wanted to, they could say, yes, we offer IOLTA accounts, the service charge is $12 a month. And if they did that, I think the system would kind of fall apart pretty fast. There are a couple of reasons why they don't. One is because maybe they just, you know, want to go along with the system and not have the system fall apart. The other thing, too, it seems to me it's a service to the attorney because, like I say, if the attorney is authorized to make deposits to cover that service charge, but if you forget one month to go put in your $12, then you'll have an overdraft on the account just caused by the service charge. So most of the banks that I'm aware of, I have mine at U.S. Bank, and I'm guessing that other major banks probably have the same policy, is that they just waive the service charge on the IOLTA account. And it's probably a lot of work for the bank to set these up initially, although I guess once they have it set up, their computer can probably handle everything pretty well. So they routinely send those checks for 42 cents to the state, and they waive the service charge on the IOLTA account. Like I say, I suspect these IOLTA accounts must be a headache for the bank, and I'm guessing they only grudgingly go along with it. But they do grudgingly go along with it, partly because, or mostly, I imagine, because they are aware that every lawyer in the state, or that is any lawyer in the state who handles client funds, is required to have one. Therefore, they offer them as a service, recognizing that the attorney will probably do their other banking business at the same bank. But I doubt if they really enjoy offering these IOLTA accounts. And I'm sure you cannot walk into a bank and open just an IOLTA account. I think they would probably reserve it just for attorneys who do other banking business there. But like I say, the larger banks, U.S. Bank I know doesn't charge any fee. I'm guessing it's the same for Wells Fargo and another large bank like that. And probably even, the Farmers State Bank of some little town, they're probably geared up to do these too. So if you go into the bank to open it up, and if you ask for the IOLTA account, they'll probably know what you're talking about. And there are very specific requirements for the bank as well contained in the rule. So in the unlikely event that the banker does not know what an IOLTA account is, you have to make sure that you're getting an account that complies with all these other rules. Now, one thing, I graduated from law school about 20 years ago, and one thing that has changed is I mean, there have always been very strict rules on your office account and your, on your trust account and the kind of records that you have to have for your trust account. One thing that is new, is that there are also rules governing your office account. Now, one issue that could come up with an attorney who's engaged in the practice of law, maybe only part-time, maybe somebody works as not actually working as an attorney, but maybe practice law on the side, and occasionally do services for friends or relatives. Well, first of all, you are required to maintain books and records to show your income and expenses. So you have to, maintain records of your law office, and you have to retain those records for 6 years. So in addition to the trust account record-keeping requirements that have been around for a long time, you're required to keep books and records for your law office. Now, if it's a part-time law office, probably not too burdensome, but you do have to take a look at that rule. Make sure, even if you're not practicing law on a regular basis, if you are, quote, engaged in the practice of law, you do have to maintain records for your office. And you must maintain them. And in Minnesota, when you send in, this is probably true in Wisconsin, but in Minnesota, when you send in your annual renewal form to renew your license, you have to, one of the things that you're signing there is that you are maintaining those records. And also, if you do have a trust account, on that occasion, you have to report the trust account number. Now, for me, in the kind of practice I do, I have the trust account. I oftentimes get my trust account checkbook out once a year just to look up the account number, because there might be years when I've not actually had any activity in that account. But you have to report that compliance annually. And in some situations, too, you are required to have a, quote, office account for your law office. So if you practice law only occasionally, be sure to take a look at Rule 1.15, or in Minnesota, that document that we'll get to in a minute that tells what books and records you have to have. Because in some situations, you are required to have a separate account for your law office. If you practice law full time, you're probably normally going to have that. But some people who, maybe practice part time and, occasionally write a will for a friend or relative or something, and get paid and just deposit that in their own personal checking account. If you are in that situation, it's a good idea to read the rule carefully and make sure that you're not required to have a separate account for it. In Wisconsin, it's kind of outside the scope of this program to go through exactly what the records are that are required. In Wisconsin, the reason why the Wisconsin rule takes up so many more pages in the rule court book than the other states is because right there in the rule they go into all the specifics that are required for it. In Minnesota and Iowa, on the other hand, partly because these requirements tend to change occasionally, the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility publishes annually a list, a description of the kinds of books and records that you have to maintain. And that is on the Supreme Court's website. I have the link for it here. So for the Minnesota attorney, once a year or so, you should take a look at that. In Iowa, the court also has a similar document. The Iowa version of it actually goes into a little bit more detail, and it kind of goes beyond the rules a little bit, and it gives some pointers on how to avoid getting into trouble. So even if you practice law in some other state, that Iowa document is actually written to be a little bit more readable, and it gives some helpful pointers like I say, that go beyond the rules on how to avoid some pitfalls. So even if you're in one of the other states, you might want to take a look at that document because it could prove helpful in the practice of law. Whereas the Wisconsin rule and the Minnesota document are just outline the requirements a little bit more. One thing that's covered in the Iowa document, for example, is the pitfall of asking your client to wait until tomorrow to cash a check. I admit this is something I've done in the past because you if you settle a case and you the client has to come in and sign the back of the settlement check. You have to sign it, then you deposit it into the trust account, and then you write yourself a check for your fee, and you write your client a check for the rest of it. Well, the client has to make a special trip to your office to come and sign the back of the check, the nice thing to do to be a nice guy is to say, well, I'll just go ahead and give you your check right now. It's dated tomorrow. Please wait until tomorrow to cash it because it's not any good until I get to the bank and deposit this into the trust account. That could backfire on you if the client decides to ignore your advice and go cash the check today because then there would not be funds in there to cover it. And backtracking a little bit, we see that the financial institution has certain requirements for the trust account. They are listed in the rules. A large bank like U.S. Bank or Wells Fargo or something, you can be pretty sure if they're offering IOLTA accounts, they probably comply with those rules. But if it's a smaller bank that's never seen one of these before, you're the only lawyer in town, you might want to make sure that they're complying with all of those. But one of the requirements for a bank that offers IOLTA accounts in any of these states is that any time there is an overdraft on that trust account, they are required to report that to the state. In Minnesota, to the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility, or in Wisconsin or Iowa to the corresponding office. And that's true even if it's the friendly banker who honors the overdraft. So if you, sometimes happens, people are bad at math, and you overdraw your account by a few dollars. The bank assesses a service charge for that. But if you don't do it too often, the bank probably covers it. But even if the bank covers it, they are still required to make that notification. You probably can't stop it from happening because normally how it's set up is that the when the bank's computer spits out an overdraft notice, they mail out an overdraft notice anytime you're overdrawn at the bank. They just have the computer spit out two copies, one addressed to you and one addressed to the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility or other office. So that will kind of happen automatically. You don't want that to happen because I don't know what would happen if the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility got such a notice, but I'm sure they would come around and want to take a look at the books and records and stuff, you're going to be in a certain amount of trouble just for that overdraft. Although there could be situations where it'd be fairly innocent, but you want to watch out for that. You don't want that to happen because they're probably going to, even if it was totally innocent, you don't want them digging around trying to find something else. So you have to be careful with the trust account. And like I say, you can't just put a cushion in there worry about it. The other thing to keep in mind with trust accounts, and again, this is addressed to some extent in some of these additional documents, is to keep that overdraft from happening, you really don't want to disperse funds until the funds have cleared. And in fact, that's what the rules say. But as you're aware, probably checks never really clear. The only thing that can happen to a check is that it will not clear. Now, if you get a settlement check from the insurance company, insurance, you know, checks from insurance companies, if it really is a check from the insurance company, I don't think they bounce too often. Even there, it's a theoretical possibility. You know, you get the settlement check from the insurance company, you deposit it in your trust account, you disperse it, and you pick up the newspaper the next morning and you read that that insurance company has become insolvent and that check is no good. You know, that could happen. So you have to be mindful of that situation. And in that case, maybe you couldn't prevent it. But if it's a settlement check that maybe directly from a third party, from the tortfeasor wrote you a check. Well, he sees the tort, so maybe he's going to bounce a check too. So before dispersing those funds, you want to make sure that they have cleared. The Wisconsin has some more specific rules on that because there are some exceptions, for example, in real estate transactions. But in general, you want to make sure that the check is cleared before you disperse funds from the trust account to avoid overdrafts. So that kind of wraps up the rules about trust accounts in the various states. But like I say, that is just kind of the highlights. In most of the other rules, we're going to excruciating detail. But if I had done that on there, I probably could have made a six-hour program just out of that rule. You have to. It's a good idea to look over those rules, and especially those other documents that explain those rules and some additional requirements. Well, all of the rules that start with a one are talking about the relationship you have with your client, the duties that you owe the client, so we continue on with that. So 1.15 was talking about your obligations to your client to safeguard their property. Rule 1.16 talks about the situations where you may or must decline a representation, not take on the case, or if the case is going on, the situations where you are required or permitted to withdraw from the case. Now, the rules are basically the same on whether or not you can not take the case in the first place or whether you are required or permitted to withdraw from the case. The exception is, though, that you're generally never required to take on a case in the first place. So declining a representation, the rule doesn't talk about the situations where you may decline to take the case, because that's pretty much all the time. You may always decline to take the case in the first place. Just because somebody walks into your office does not mean that you are required to be their lawyer. You can decline pretty much all the time. But there are some situations where you may not take the case. So there are the situations where you may not take the case, where you're not allowed to take it in the first place. Those are the same as the rules for when you must withdraw from the case. And you can't take on a case in the first place, and you must withdraw from a case if you're already involved in it in three situations. One is if that representation would result in a violation of the rules or some other law. So most commonly that might be a conflict of interest. As rules 1.7 and 1.8 in an earlier part of the program talked about the conflict of interest rules. So if the representation would violate one of those conflict of interest rules, then you can't take on the new client. And if that conflict of interest comes to light in the middle of the case, then you are required to withdraw from representing the client because it violates the rules. It causes a conflict of interest. So most commonly where that might arise, for example, would be you were doing a joint representation. You are representing both the plaintiff, you can't represent both the plaintiff and the defendant, but you are representing two plaintiffs, the driver of a car and the passenger in the car, and they were both injured by another car's negligence. So you're representing both of those plaintiffs. That's probably okay, but you have to watch out for that even from the beginning, because the situation could arise that it turns out your driver was also negligent. So you have the passenger would possibly have a claim against the driver. So you would have a conflict of interest between your two clients because your plaintiff one, the passenger, has the right to sue plaintiff two, the driver. So in that situation, you would probably be required to withdraw from the case. Or if you saw that originally, you would be required not to take the case. The other situation where you shall withdraw and you can't take on the case in the first place is if your physical or mental condition materially impairs your ability. So you become disabled or you can't take the practice of law anymore and you're having a breakdown. Well, then you have to withdraw from the case. The third situation is if you are fired, if the lawyer is discharged. And it doesn't say that if you're discharged either with, for a good reason, maybe you were being the best lawyer in the case, the best possible lawyer. You did nothing wrong and the client says, you're fired. I don't want you to be my lawyer anymore. You can't continue the representation in that case. Now, in that case, you might be entitled to your fee, but as we learned in Rule 1.2, is that the client is always the one making important decisions in the case. You know, should I settle? Should I go to trial? Should I, should I file a lawsuit? The client always has to make those important decisions, or pretty much all decisions. And the biggest decision is, to have you as their lawyer or not. So you always have to respect that and withdraw from the case if they tell you to withdraw from the case. Regardless of fault, regardless of whether you're entitled to keep your fee. So those are the situations where you're required to withdraw from the case. It's subject to an exception we'll get to in a little bit. But there are also situations where you may withdraw from taking the case. Now, once again, you're never required to take a case, other than maybe a few unusual situations. So this rule talks in terms of when you may quit. And number one is, and this is pretty wide open because rule part one here, the first reason why you may withdraw is that if it doesn't have any material adverse effect on your client, so if it doesn't do your client any harm, then you can always withdraw, so they can get another lawyer. Number two and three, the client persists in a course of conduct involving your services that is criminal or fraudulent, or they're using your services to perpetrate a crime or a fraud. You can withdraw in that situation. And as we learned before, one of the things that you're not allowed to do is to perpetrate the crime or fraud. But that could be a situation where the best cure for it would be just to withdraw from the case entirely. And this rule permits you to do that. If the client wants to take some action, again, that's their choice, what actions they're going to take. But if it's something that you find so repugnant or you fundamentally disagree with it, then you can withdraw. Now, you're a pro-life lawyer and you represent some clinic and they want to, they've changed their hospital plan and now they want to do abortions and that's just totally repugnant to what you believe in, then you could withdraw in that case if it's something that you just fundamentally disagree with. You can withdraw if the client fails to substantially fulfill an obligation under the contract. In other words, if they stop paying you, you can withdraw if you're not getting paid. And again, that's one, though, where there might be an exception a little bit later on. But in general, you can quit if you're not getting paid. But first of all, you do have to give them sufficient warning. So you can't... you send out the bill on the first of the month, and then on the second of the month you quit. Well, no, you probably can't do that. You have to give them a little bit of warning at least. You can withdraw if a continued representation would be an unreasonable financial burden, or if the client has made it unreasonably difficult. So you took this case in good faith, thought you could do it, but it turns out you need to hire the $1 million an hour expert witness, and you don't have the $1 million an hour, something like that. And then number seven, if there's any other good cause. So that list is not exclusive. There might be other reasons that are not covered by the rule. Now, the exception, though, is that even if you are permitted to withdraw, you still must comply with any law requiring notice or permission by the court. So you would have to consult, if you're involved in some litigation, you would have to consult the court rules to see if you have opportunity to withdraw. And chances are the rules of criminal procedure, if you look at them, will say something like you can only withdraw from the case with permission from the court. And if the court doesn't want to give you permission, you probably can't. Well, you can't. So you would still have to comply with that rule. Even if your client hasn't paid you or if any of those other good reasons exist, you would still have to comply with that requirement to get court permission. And in general, in a criminal case, that permission will probably not be granted. Once you sign on that you're going to be this person's attorney, you're probably stuck. So you probably can't withdraw. And even possibly in a civil case, depending maybe on how close it is to trial. Going into court the day before or the morning of trial saying, judge, I'm withdrawing from the case as of right now. Well, the judge might not give you permission in that circumstance, so you have to watch out. Once again, and it reiterates that if the court orders, you must continue representing the client, even if there's good cause. So if the even if it's not specifically addressed by the rules, if the judge orders you to keep representing this person, you have to do that. If you do terminate the representation, you have to take reasonable steps to protect the client's interests. So, for example, if you're quitting the day before the statute of limitations expires. Well, maybe you have to, draw up a pro se complaint for your client or something. You have to take reasonable steps. You have to return the client's papers at the end of the representation if the client is entitled to them. The reason for those last words is that if, for example, a client retained you to draft a will, and you get to work, you finish drafting the will, the client says, oh, I'm not paying you, I want my file back. That piece of paper is in the file, the will that you just wrote, but the client hasn't paid for that, so the client's probably not entitled to that particular paper. But in general, the file and the papers belong to the client. Minnesota has a little bit more specificity, especially when it comes to copying costs. The question is, well, can I make a copy of the file for my own records? Well, the answer is probably yes. For the question of can I say to my client, you can't have the file back until you pay me for making copies? Well, no, you probably can't do that. So you can probably copy it, but you can't condition it upon payment of the copying costs. So those are withdrawing from a case, Rule 1.16. Rule 1.17 talks about the sale of a law practice. And the reason this rule is here is because in an earlier part of the rules, we talked about referral fees. And you might be able to share a fee with another lawyer, but you can't just have an outright referral fee that I will send clients to you and you will pay me for sending clients to you. Well, if you sell your law practice, that's kind of what you're doing. You sell your practice, and then somebody calls you up and says, I want a lawyer. And they say, well, I'm not practicing law anymore. I sold it to the new guy. You call him. Well, you said, I'm referring you to the new guy, the guy who bought my practice. So that's one of the things that the new person paid for. Well, that's permissible if it's a bona fide sale of your law practice. And it has to be either a sale of your entire practice or it can be sale of a particular practice area. So, for example, you decide to, retire from the DWI practice, but you're going to continue with your personal injury cases. So you sell your DWI practice to another attorney. That's permissible, selling one practice area or one geographic area. So if you have offices in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Madison, Wisconsin, and you decide to sell your Madison office to somebody else, but keep practicing in Minnesota, that's permissible. But the reason the rule is written in that way is because you can't say, I'm going to sell you the Smith case, I'm going to retire from the Smith case and sell that to you, because that would just be a referral fee. You have to give notice to the clients. Wisconsin, they say it has to be the affected clients. I don't know if that makes any difference. and the fees can't go up as a result of the sale. So if you were charging $100 an hour, you sold your practice to the new guy for $200, and he normally works it for $200 an hour. Those clients that went along with the sale have to get the old $100 price. The rest of these rules, 1 through 1.17, talked about your duties to your clients and former clients. Rule 1.18 talks about your duties to prospective clients. And somebody becomes a prospective client by virtue of communication, because a prospective client is somebody who talks to you about the possibility of forming an attorney-client relationship. And before I forget, I better give our second code word. And our second code word for the podcast listeners is prospective. Prospective, as in prospective clients. Prospective is the second and final code word. Well, a prospective client, again, is somebody who comes into your office or whatever and discusses the possibility of forming an attorney-client relationship. In other words, the definition of prospective client is based upon the exchange of information. It's not just somebody who came into your office or somebody that you saw trip and fall in the street. They become a prospective client only if they talk to you. And the reason for that is because, in general, that information that they give to you is confidential and is governed by the confidentiality rules of current clients. In general, if you have learned information about a client that could be significantly harmful in those discussions, even if they did not become a client, then you can't represent somebody materially adverse to them. And in general, that extends to other lawyers in your firm. So if the drunk driver walks into your office and says, I was out drunk driving last night. I was totally negligent. I was totally drunk, and I injured some people. And you say, well, I'm sorry, we don't take defendants. We only represent plaintiffs. Well, if the plaintiff comes in the next day, you can't take their case because you learned information that could be significantly harmful about that prospective client. So you can't take the case if those communications have taken place. And again, other lawyers in your firm couldn't take the case either. Now, there's one exception to that about the situation when other lawyers in your firm would be able to represent them. And that is if, first of all, if everybody consents, then it's okay. You can consent to most things. But the main exception where other lawyers in your firm could continue representing that person is if you took some reasonable steps to avoid exposure to the information. So the guy comes in and says, hi, I'm going to be a defendant in a case. And you say, oh, I'm sorry, we don't take defendants. And then he starts blurting out, but I was drunk, I was negligent, it was all my fault. If he blurts out that information, well, you told him to be quiet. You didn't want the information in the first place. So I think there you probably took reasonable measures to avoid exposure to the information. Well, you're still barred from taking the case, but the other lawyers in your office could still take that case. So what that's designed to do is to keep somebody from intentionally going around and preventing every lawyer in town from taking his case. You go to all the big firms and blurt out information that is harmful to you. If you did that to every single lawyer in town, then no lawyer in town could ever sue you about that. At least the lawyers that you blurted it out to, that strategy worked with respect to them, but at least the other lawyers in their office who did not hear the blurted out information can still continue to represent it. Well, in almost 3 hours of this program, we have now finally gotten through Rule 1. Rule 1 covers a lot of stuff because that, again, is all the duties to your client. Rule 2 just talks about a couple of little situations about different roles that you can play. First of all, Rule 2.1 talks about you as an advisor. That's what lawyers do. They give legal advice. Well, Rule 2.1 just makes clear that if you want to, you may look into give advice based upon things other than the law, such as moral, economic, social, and political factors. You don't have to, but it just says that that's permissible. So if your bank is a client and they come in and say, we want to foreclose this mortgage and we want to do it on December 24th, you could say, well, you know, that might look bad in the newspaper. I mean, they have every legal right if they want to do it on December 24th, but, you know, you can give them some advice that, you know, from a public relations perspective, that might not be a good thing to do. You are permitted but not required to do that. Rule 2.2 does not exist. I don't know why they have a Rule 2.2 because there's nothing there. So maybe that's something that was repealed. But Rule 2.3 talks about the situations where you might be evaluating things for third parties. So, for example, you're representing somebody in a personal injury case, and you know, their landlord calls and says, you know, my guy's rent is due, but he tells me that he's about to settle this case. You know, is that true? Or does he have a good case? Well, there you're giving information about your case, evaluating it, talking about your client's situation for a third party. And if, you know, if the client is okay with that, I mean, that's confidential information, but if the client is okay with it, that's okay. You know, and if that information is going to help your client, well, good. You know, say, yeah, please hold off on foreclosing because that, you know, he's going to get that $1 million settlement any day now. But there might be situations where your evaluation is that, I'm representing him, but it turns out that's a really lousy case. He's not going to get any money from it. Well, anytime that evaluation will adversely affect your client, then you have to get your client's consent to do that. In any situation where you are a third-party neutral under Rule 2.4, you have to make sure that everybody is aware that you are not their lawyer, that, that you know, if you're the mediator in the case, you're not the lawyer for these parties. And if somebody's maybe a little confused and they think that you are their lawyer, you have to clear that up. Rule 3.1, RUEL, I see I have here. I must be a word because my spell checker didn't pick it up. Rule 3 talks about your duties to the outside world, the court, the other parties. You can only advance meritorious claims. You can't file frivolous claims. But the exception to that is no matter how frivolous, the defendant in a criminal case always has the right to plead guilty. And that's, for the purposes of these rules, plead not guilty. Did I say guilty? A defendant always has the right to plead not guilty. And for the purposes of this rule, that extends to anything that could result in a deprivation of liberty, such as, you know, a civil commitment or something. No matter how frivolous, you can require the other side to put on its strict proof. Rule 3.2, you can't, you have to make reasonable efforts to expedite litigation consistent with your client's interests. So you can't just delay for the sake of delay, but, you know, if delay is in your client's interest, you're not violating this rule by that delay. You have to, you can't make false statements to the judge or to the court, and if there's a prior false statement that you become aware of, you have to correct it. You can't offer evidence known to be false. And if you are aware of a controlling legal authority that the other side does not bring up, you have to bring that to the court's attention. Rule 3.4, you have to be fair to the other side and to the opposing party and the opposing counsel. And most of these are kind of common sense, except the very last one on the top of page 12 kind of bears the reminder. You can't request of somebody other than your client that they not give information to the other party. So you're representing the plaintiff. You talk talking about the, you know, talking to a witness to the accident, and, you know, you say, well, thank you for this information. By the way, we'd appreciate if you don't talk to the attorney for the defendant because he's, you know, he's a crook. Don't talk to him. Well, you can't do that. You can't request that they not talk to the other party. Unless it's your client or a relative or an agent or an employee, or if you think that that person's interest will not be adversely affected. So you have to be careful with that. Impartiality and decorum of the tribunal, Minnesota and Wisconsin depart a little bit in the language, but you can't, you have to use decorum in the courtroom, and you can't deal ex parte with people during the proceeding. One thing that Minnesota makes clear is that one thing to watch out for is during a trial, you're not supposed to make ex parte contact with the jurors or judges unless it's permitted by the court rules. One thing to watch out for in Minnesota is that, you know, maybe you don't practice, you know, you don't do any litigation, whatever. You've never been even close to a courtroom. You can still run afoul of this rule because during a trial of any case,